The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Well, hey there, my friends, and welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson. For today, we're going to cover British killer John Cannon. I had never heard of him, and I came across an article about how this man, who is a convicted murderer with a history of kidnapping, rape, and attempted rape, will likely be eligible for release from prison on parole in 2022. Now, based on what I've read about John Cannon, I don't believe he should ever be released, and I'm sure that the victims of his families agree. He is a dangerous man. He is lethally charming. He has a long history of committing violent attacks against women, and not just random attacks. Some of them were also against his romantic partners. Cannon, who fancies himself a bit of a ladies' man, had a stroke in prison back in the summer of 2019, and ever since then, police have been racing against the clock to locate one of Cannon's suspected victims, Susie Lamplugh, who went missing on July 28, 1986, and was legally declared dead in 1993. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. From a young age, John Cannon knew how to charm women into giving him whatever he wanted. Born in Warwickshire, England on February 24, 1954, Cannon lived with his mother and father. He attended a private all-boys school and recalled how when he was just 4 years old, he, quote, had a teacher that always ate biscuits during break time. Cannon bragged later in life about how he used his charm to persuade her to allow him to have biscuits as well, end quote. A few years later, Cannon was allegedly sexually assaulted by one of his teachers. This teacher took him into an empty classroom and instructed 7-year-old Cannon to pull down his pants. The teacher then touched Cannon's genitals and told Cannon to touch him too. John was so terrified of the teacher that he obeyed, afterwards feeling too scared and ashamed to tell anyone what had happened. This abuse continued for several months, and the psychological effects of it caused Cannon to develop a stammer, and he became obviously agitated and nervous about going to school and just being in a classroom. He would make excuses and fight as much as he could, begging his parents not to take him to school, and it finally got to a point where his parents brought 9-year-old John to see a doctor in 1963, hoping to find a cause or a solution for the nervousness. This abuse caused John to feel isolated and different from his classmates. He shut down, he wouldn't interact with them, he had no real close friends, and later, quote, claimed he always had to deal with humiliation and shame, which led him to express anger and resentment, end quote. Which of course it did. He was too ashamed to admit a grown man had taken advantage of him because I'm sure part of it was he didn't want to get in trouble, even though he did absolutely nothing wrong, if this is actually true. The only wrong person here is the teacher who thinks that abusing children put in their care is acceptable. But for John, his fear in disclosing the truth only exacerbated his feelings of isolation, and as a result, he began to resent the world, and additionally, his feelings and understanding towards sex became extremely warped. He was introduced to sex as a power move, not as an act of love like it should be. When Cannon was 14 years old, he was sentenced to a 1-year probation period after, quote, he indecently assaulted a woman in a phone box in the Birmingham suburb of Erdington, end quote. In 1971, Cannon was now 17 years old and extremely athletic. He was even offered the opportunity to train with the Birchfield Harriers. His father, unfortunately, was against the idea and decided not to let his son do it. Cannon also, quote, gained 5 certificates of secondary education and 3 ordinary level general certificates of education, end quote. With no real plans for his future after school, John joined the Merchant Navy, but that only lasted for 3 months. It's likely by this point, John just wanted to escape. He wanted away from everyone, including his family, and decided that joining the Navy would solve this dilemma. Cannon began dating June Vale around this time as well, and they got married nearly 7 years later in May 1978. Apparently, Cannon wasn't too keen on getting married and had said that, quote, he was hassled into marrying her. His mother-in-law was pressuring them to start a family. June then turned up pregnant, end quote. John believed this pregnancy was on purpose, and the couple welcomed a daughter, naming her Louise. Over the next 2 years, John's behavior became a bit erratic. He would constantly drink and smoke. Instead of coming home from work to see his family, he would stay out all night at clubs and bars. With the amount that he was suspected to be drinking on a daily basis, many believed John was an alcoholic. On Valentine's Day in 1980, he met 32-year-old Sharon Major while out at a bar. She and John both lied about their marital status and began having an affair. Less than 2 months later, John moved into Sharon's home, living not only with Sharon, but with her children. So he neglected his wife and daughter at this point and went to live with this new girlfriend. He exchanged them for a new family that he took trips with. He also met Sharon's family not long after they began seeing each other. At the beginning of December, John and Sharon had a big fight because John got jealous that Sharon's now ex-husband was coming to visit for Christmas to see his children. Showing a flash of possessive behavior, John couldn't understand why Sharon was going to let her children see their father for the holiday, so they ended up not spending most of December together, and they didn't speak again until December 30th. Cannon went over to Sharon's home with a bottle of wine in tow and asked if they could talk things over. Sharon agreed and let John into the house. After they talked for a bit, things began to turn sexual, and Sharon claimed, quote, that during intercourse, he put his hands around her neck so that she could barely breathe, end quote. He also allegedly said he was going to kill her, flashing a gun around, but it was later determined to be an air gun. John continued to attack Sharon during this, and she finally shoved him down the stairs just to get away from him, and according to her, it's like something snapped inside of John. When he was shoved down the stairs, he almost had a light bulb come on over his head, and he realized what he was doing and went back to being his old self. He was supposedly shocked that he had hurt her and apologized, but even as they drove to the hospital so Sharon could receive treatment, he told her once again that he had meant to kill her. Years later, when John Cannon was charged for multiple crimes, including the murder of Shirley Ann Banks, he was also charged with rape against Sharon Major for this incident. On March 6, 1981, John walked into a women's clothing store owned by 37-year-old Jean Bradford. Her 17-month-old son was also with her, and when John entered the store, Jean recalled he had a handkerchief up to his face, acting like he was maybe wiping a runny nose. As he walked closer to Jean, he pulled a knife out and threatened both her and her son with it. He yelled at her to give him whatever money she had, and as Jean was handing over the money, her mother walked into the store, disrupting the robbery, and this angered Cannon even more, and he threatened Jean's mother with the knife before tying her up and ordering her to sit there with Jean's son while he raped Jean in front of both of them. Thankfully, Jean's husband walked into the store and interrupted John during this act, who ran out the back door, and Jean and her husband immediately reported the rape to the police. John was soon arrested and questioned not only in the rape of Jean Bradford, but he was also asked about what happened with Sharon Major on December 30th. Cannon received an 8-year jail sentence on June 26, 1981, which included 5 years for the rape of Jean Bradford and 3 years for theft. Prior to his arrest, John Cannon worked as a car salesman and had also stolen money and a car from the dealership after he quit. In February 1982, Cannon was moved to Horfield Prison in Bristol, where he would spend the next 2 years before being transferred again, this time to the Verne, which is located in Portland. Just 2 days after he arrived at the Verne, John's father came to visit him. He had found out that he was terminally ill and wanted to attempt to make amends with his son. Thankfully, John was willing to visit with his father because this would be the last time that John ever saw his father alive before he passed away from cancer in February of 1985. The following year, on January 25th, 1986, John Cannon was transferred for the last time to Wormwood Scrubs Prison in London and was apparently allowed to participate in a pre-release program for about 6 months up until his release. He was given some freedom, and it sounds like he was maybe allowed out of the prison for short amounts of time, sort of testing the waters to see if he was ready to re-enter society. And as I continue on, you'll see that regardless of how much time Cannon has already spent in jail, he was not even remotely rehabilitated. During this 6 month trial release period, a woman named Sandra Court was strangled to death on May 3rd. Her body was discovered near Bournemouth, and John was reportedly also in Bournemouth that day. After Sandra was found, police received a letter in which, quote, "the handwriting appeared to be disguised as someone left-handed who was writing with their right hand. John was left-handed." John was questioned about this murder. John still claims to not know this woman, and there was no concrete evidence tying him to this crime, so he was not charged with the crime, only questioned about it, end quote. Despite the likelihood that John Cannon had something to do with Sandra's murder, he was released from prison on July 25th, 1986. He had a longer rap sheet than work record, and yet somehow was able to present himself as a, quote, BMW driving yuppie, end quote. He dressed well, he was well-spoken and charming. He would apparently try to woo women by buying them roses, chocolates, champagne, all of the, I guess, stereotypical acts of romance and courtship. Don't get me wrong, they are so nice, but these gestures, coupled with his smooth-talking charm, always seemed to work in terms of convincing women to trust him. Just 3 days after his release, on July 28th, 25-year-old Susie Lamplugh went missing, and Cannon is still to this day considered the main suspect. Susie worked as a real estate agent and had an appointment to meet a Mr. Kipper at 1 p.m. on the day she disappeared. She left her office at Sturgis & Sons at 12:40 p.m. and was seen approximately 10 minutes later waiting outside the property she was planning to show. A man showed up at 1 p.m. as expected, but a witness saw both Susie and this man leaving the property only minutes after he had arrived. Co-workers realized something was wrong when time went by and Susie never returned from showing this man the property. Her manager even called Susie's mother, Diana, and asked if she had any idea where her daughter might be. That right there is every parent's worst nightmare, receiving a phone call asking where your child is and you don't know. Susie's manager then called the police and reported her missing at 6:45 p.m. that same day. Police found her white Ford Fiesta approximately 1 mile from her office, and it was, quote, badly parked, handbrake off, driver's door unlocked, purse still in the car, indicating she left in a hurry or was forced to leave. Witnesses also recalled seeing a mid-1970s dark blue BMW, the type of car John drove, parked at the location of the property that day, end quote. Police noted that there was no real indication of a struggle, no fingerprints aside from Susie's, and the keys to the car were missing. John was questioned about Susie's disappearance, but he told police he couldn't remember what he had done that day, and since there was really no significant reliable evidence to concretely link him to Susie's disappearance, they couldn't really do anything at the time. But again, he is still the main suspect. Even now, as he sits in prison, he vehemently denies having anything to do with it. Susie's body has never been found, and she was legally declared dead in 1993 as a suspected murder victim. All right, my friends, I'm going to take a short break, so hang tight. I'll be right back. And welcome back, my friends. A few months after Susie's disappearance, 32-year-old John Cannon met up with his one-time solicitor, Annabelle Rose, in September 1986. Annabelle worked for a law firm in London and had assisted John with determining his parental rights after he was arrested and sent to jail for the rape of Jean Bradford in 1981. When John was convicted of the rape, his wife June divorced him, and John claims after his release, he and Annabelle met up for a few drinks and then had consensual sex. He apparently believed that they had chemistry from the very first moment they met, despite Annabelle also being married at the time. John's version of chemistry, of course, is probably a little warped. This is a man who believed he could quite literally charm the pants off of any woman he met, and he would get angry if a woman rejected him. His only real relationship with a woman was supposedly his mother. According to John's brother, Anthony, quote, "he idolized her. When he grew up, I don't think he ever had a single friend," end quote. Which goes back to John's claim that he was sexually assaulted by his teacher as a young boy, and feeling so ashamed and so turned in on himself that he couldn't relate to other people, let alone have friends. So his mother was probably the only person that he felt comfortable talking to. John and Annabelle continued to see each other, but later that month, in September 1986, John tried to commit suicide by overdosing on 68 paracetamol tablets, which is basically just an acetaminophen pain reliever and along the lines of Tylenol. On October 6th, 1986, John spotted Donna Tucker in her parked car reading a book. She had taken a drive to allow her and her husband to cool off after they had just had an argument, so she got in the car, drove a ways away, pulled over, and just decided to read a book and relax. She noticed a man walking back and forth past her car, seemingly lost. He tapped on her window and asked her if she had a map. Distracted for a moment by looking for the map, the man opened the car door and held a knife to Donna's throat. Cannon then climbed inside the car and proceeded to rape her both vaginally and anally. After the 45-minute attack was over, Donna drove back home and told her husband what had happened. They both went to the police and reported the rape, police launching an investigation and searching for the rapist. John was brought in and questioned, but he denied being involved. Without any evidence or a positive ID from Donna, police were unable to charge him with the assault. After the assault on Donna Tucker, John moved back in with his mother in Sutton Coldfield on November 30th, 1986. He was still in a relationship with Annabelle Rose at this time, and that lasted until August 18th of the following year, when Annabelle ended it. She had discovered just how controlling and possessive Cannon was. He apparently didn't trust her and, quote, "used money from his father's will to hire a private investigator to follow her," end quote. After the relationship ended, John was furious. How dare a woman reject him? And he intended to blackmail Annabelle by telling her husband about the affair, but Annabelle had already confessed everything to her husband, which triggered the breakup between John and Annabelle. So Annabelle had already told her husband about the affair before she ended the relationship. She also quit her job at the law firm. Also, during this time, John met 24-year-old Gilly Page, and later, Gilly recalled being threatened by John a few times during their short relationship. On September 11th, 1987, John met another woman, Marija Vilsint, and took her out on a date. Just 2 days later, he was reportedly very charming to both Marija and her mother, but their relationship didn't last long. By the end of September, John decided to sign up for a video dating agency. He submitted his tape under an alias, John Peterson, but his video was never shown to any prospective matches because the owners of the agency didn't get a good feeling about him just based on his tape and his very specific criteria for the kind of woman he was looking for that he had written down on his application. John was becoming more and more unstable, more and more dangerous. A couple of weeks after his dating submission, he attacked Julia Holman as she walked to her car. A man came up behind her and tried to force himself into her car with her, but luckily, she was able to fight him off and the man fled. Probably feeling angry about his lack of success the night before, John next targeted 29-year-old Shirley Banks. Shirley had left home, telling her husband that she was going shopping for a new dress, but much like Susie Lamplew, the hours passed, and Shirley never returned home. This caused her husband to grow increasingly concerned, and by this time, hours after she left the store, Shirley was, quote, held captive at his flat and forced to phone in sick to the factory where she worked as a textiles manager, end quote. At the time of the call, Shirley was with John Cannon, and he had instructed her not to let on that she was in trouble. Otherwise, I'm sure her coworker or whoever she reached at the office would have tried to keep her on the phone or would have notified the police for help. Shirley was last seen in a car park in Bristol the evening of October 8th, and police also obtained a sales receipt from a store called Debenhams, where she had in fact purchased a dress at 7:26 p.m. The following day, an older couple named Mr. and Mrs. Hart were on an afternoon drive near the Clifton Suspension Bridge around 2:15 p.m. They saw smoke coming from the nearby woods, so they pulled over to see if they could spot anything. It was kind of unusual to see just a plume of smoke coming out of the woods. With the windows partially rolled down, they heard a man shouting, "Come on, come on," and it sounded like he was arguing with someone. The Harts couldn't see the other person that this man was supposedly with, but they heard thumping, like something or someone was being hit. Growing more concerned at what they were hearing, they continued to wait until they saw anything that might explain what was going on. All of a sudden, they saw a man dragging something heavy in his hand through the trees and then reaching down to punch it. It was then the Harts realized this man was punching a person as they heard screams while the man continued to shout things like, "I told you what I would do." They watched as the man continued to assault the person on the ground. And I understand that this was a time before cell phones, so before people get all up in arms about why the Harts didn't do anything, this was 1980s. Late 1980s. No cell phones, they were elderly, and definitely no match physically for what would later be determined to be John Cannon. But just how awful would it be to sit there watching and listening to someone being attacked, knowing that if you tried to intervene, you would also be subjected to the same thing? As the assault continued, the screaming suddenly stopped and the Harts could hear choking sounds coming from the bush as the man had his victim on the ground, and then there was silence. Mrs. Hart looked at her husband and both of them just had shock in their eyes at what they had just witnessed, and by this point, Cannon realized he was being watched and tried to hide in the grass. But Mrs. Hart rolled her car window down even further and yelled at him, asking what he was doing, and I gotta hand it to her at this point. She is a sassy, ballsy woman, and good for you. She watched as this man disappeared into the trees, only to jump in surprise when he leapt out of the woods near the car and called her a cow. He screamed "cow" at her before he ran away. When the Harts later told the police what they had witnessed, Mrs. Hart recalled how she, quote, saw a crazed look on his face and he appeared to be breathing heavily from his exertions, end quote. Terrified, the Harts sped away from the man and sadly would later find out that they had witnessed the murder of Shirley Ann Banks. Cannon wasn't a suspect in her murder until he was arrested for threatening a woman named Carmel Cleary at her store, as well as another customer on October 29, 1987. John attempted to flee when a man intervened in the attack and chased him down the street. Running as hard as he could, Cannon dropped some of his belongings, including the knife as well as a jacket that had traces of blood on it. While searching his vehicle, police found Shirley's tax disc, which is the UK equivalent of a car registration here in the US, and they found it in his glove box. John was taken into custody and held for 17 days as police questioned him, but he was extremely uncooperative and believed that by not telling police what he knew, he somehow maintained control of the situation. During this 2.5 week interrogation period, police conducted a lineup for Julia Holman, who picked Cannon out as her attacker. He was then charged with Julia's attempted kidnapping as well. Cannon still refused to answer any questions about Shirley Banks' disappearance, but police were very confident that he was involved, so they continued to question him. On December 22, 1987, police went to search his home and found Shirley's fingerprints inside, so they were convinced with that evidence that they had found the man responsible for her disappearance and went to question him one last time. They told Cannon that, based on the fact that they had found Shirley's prints in his home, he had lied about knowing her. Shirley's bludgeoned and badly decomposed body wouldn't be found until April 3, 1988. Basil and Jill Hooper were on a walk with their family for Easter Sunday and came across a body in what's known as Dead Woman's Ditch in Somerset. They called the police, who determined the remains to be that of Shirley Ann Banks. She had multiple severe head injuries. Her skull was fractured in numerous places. Her throat showed signs of significant bruising from being strangled. And after further investigation of the crime scene, detectives found a rock near the body, which had strands of blonde hair on it matching Shirley's hair. It was determined that Cannon had ultimately killed her by beating her to death with the rock. With the discovery of Shirley's body, as well as the positive identifications of John Cannon in several other assaults, he was officially charged on July 14, 1988, with the following: having sex with Sharon Major without her consent on December 30, 1980, attempting to commit buggery on Sharon Major on December 30, 1980, making an indecent assault on Sharon Major on December 30, 1980, causing grievous bodily harm on Sharon Major on December 30, 1980, raping Donna Tucker on October 6, 1986, committing buggery on Donna Tucker on October 6, 1986, indecently assaulting Donna Tucker on October 6, 1986, took Donna Tucker away against her will and by force with the intention that she would have unlawful sex with him on October 6, 1986, attempting to forcibly abduct and take away Julia Holman on October 7, 1987, attempting to take Julia Holman away against her will and by force with the intention that she would have unlawful sex with him on October 7, 1987. Between October 7th and 31st, 1987, he stole a car that was the property of Shirley Ann Banks. October 8, 1987, forcibly abducting and carrying away Shirley Ann Banks against her will. October 8, 1987, taking Shirley Ann Banks away against her will and by force with the intention that she would have unlawful sex with him. Between October 7th and 31st, 1987, murdering Shirley Ann Banks. October 29th, 1987, assaulting Carmel Cleary with the intention to rob. October 29th, 1987, detaining Carmel Cleary against her will and by force with the intention that she should have unlawful sex with him. The following year, on April 26, 1989, John Cannon, now 35 years old, was found guilty on every single one of those charges and sentenced to 3 life sentences in prison. At the time of his sentencing, Justice Drake, the judge presiding over his trial, told the court, quote, "You are extremely attractive to some women, but under that there lies a most evil violence and horrible side to your character," end quote. He tried to appeal his conviction on July 23, 1991, but the appeal was rejected. All right, my friends, that is John Cannon. He is currently serving his sentence at Full Sutton Prison in York, and police who were involved in Susie Lamplugh's investigation have stated that John Cannon must never be released from prison. Despite never admitting his involvement to police or being officially charged with her murder, he is the prime suspect and, quote, is believed to have told a former girlfriend that he strangled her and buried her body in concrete, end quote. And like I said in the opening, Cannon will become eligible for parole most likely in the year 2022, and he suffered a stroke last year in 2019, which has apparently left him partially paralyzed and in need of the use of a wheelchair. Cannon claims now to be in poor health and has complained that police are using Susie's disappearance to affect his chances of parole and that they are, quote, determined to use me as a convenient peg to hang the disappearance on, end quote. That quote makes me so mad because legally I understand why he says disappearance, but to blatantly disregard the fact that this woman has been dead for over 30 years, she has been legally declared dead since 1993, and he knows something. To just sit there in prison and act like he's the victim here is sick. Retired Detective Superintendent Jim Dickey spent 6 years investigating Susie's disappearance and went on record stating, quote, Cannon is still a suspect for the disappearance and murder of Susie Lamplugh. There's no doubt about that at all. If the parole board ever release Cannon into the general public again, the consequences of freeing a serial rapist and murderer must be on their heads. He is a threat to any young female. I strongly believe that if he were released tomorrow, he would go on to reoffend. I'm as sure as you can be that Cannon is responsible, end quote. Dickey also recently reported that, quote, a lorry driver told him that he spotted Cannon hurling a suitcase into the Grand Union Canal in Brentford at 5 a.m. in the morning of 31st July, end quote. This was just 3 days after Susie Lamplugh disappeared over 34 years ago, so police are cautiously hopeful that this new information may bring them closer to determining what happened to Susie in the days after she was reported missing. Cannon has been described by former Flames as a, quote, man with a terrible rage, willing to take revenge on women who rejected his advances, and strangers were violently attacked to satisfy the creepy car salesman's depraved lust, end quote. And as he sits in prison, the families of his victims, both confirmed and suspected, wait in agony, hoping that he'll come clean about Susie Lamplugh, as well as Sandra Court. Police are still searching for Susie Lamplugh, and in October 2018, they even dug up the garden in Cannon's mother's former home in Sutton Coldfield. Susie Lamplugh's disappearance and presumed murder by Cannon has been one of the UK's most notorious unsolved cases, and I for one hope that Cannon's chances of parole are nothing more than a pipe dream. He doesn't deserve to be free again, regardless of the status of his physical health. I could give a shit. His blatant disregard for others, for women, what he did to them, how he attacked them, he is pure evil, and he should absolutely spend the rest of his life behind bars. After he raped one of his numerous victims at knife point, most likely one of the hundreds of one-night stands that he bragged to police about, he, quote, coolly kissed her on the lips and said, take care and be good, and if you can't be good, be careful, as if nothing untoward had happened, end quote. So, yeah, let's use our brains a bit and not grant this predator parole. I don't care how poor his health may be. He deserves to sit in a cell and rot. On a separate note, if they for some reason were ever to do a movie version of John Cannon, I think he should be played by Alan Cumming. They have really similar facial features, and when I first saw a picture of Cannon, that is the actor who immediately popped into my mind. And I love Alan Cumming, and I think it would be so interesting to see him playing someone as terrible and reviled as John Cannon. Just a thought. I don't necessarily think that Cannon should get any more time in the spotlight than he already has, but just the fact that there are a lot of movies out there made about some really horrible people. It wouldn't surprise me that if at some point a film was in development about John Cannon. Okay, friends, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a lot darker and more involved than I anticipated. Like I said in the beginning, I had never heard of John Cannon. So when I came across an article about him and his potential parole, it was like something grabbed a hold of me and I had to look into the case more. And I'm so glad I did, because not for his sake, but for the women that he terrorized, and for the victims, and for the families of Susie Lamplew and Sandra Court and Shirley Ann Banks. He is so disturbing, and it's so, I don't even have the proper words to say to describe how going through this particular case made me feel. Probably because it has something to do with the fact that Cannon is still alive and he's sitting in prison and he knows something and he refuses to talk and he insists on playing the victim and complaining about his physical ailments and the fact that he is in prison and the fact that police are harming him. So again, thank you all for listening. I really appreciate you tuning in each week. And if you're a new listener, welcome. I hope that you will find time to catch up on my entire catalog of episodes. This is now episode 41. So there's lots to catch up on, as well as my Beyond the Mask episodes. As always, you can reach out to Mask of Sanity on any of the social media. Instagram is Mask of Sanity the Podcast. Twitter is Mask Sanity Pod. I have a Facebook page under Mask of Sanity the Podcast. You can also email me, maskofsanitythepodcast@gmail.com. Let me know if you have any suggestions for new cases. I have my schedule of cases planned out through the beginning of 2021, but I'm always looking for new ones, particularly cases that aren't covered as much, victims that aren't covered as much, killers that aren't covered as much, because I think it's important to bring awareness to not necessarily the killers and their exploits, but the victims and the lives that they ruined, because those are the ones who are most important. And if you haven't done so yet, please also follow the Oracle Network on Twitter and Instagram. If you're looking for a way to support Mask of Sanity, check out my Linktree. I have a Patreon, merch store, and a Ko-fi account, which is a one-time donation as opposed to Patreon, which is a monthly subscription. There are plenty of ways to support the show, or if you would like to leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform allows you to do so, I would be so appreciative of that as well. I so appreciate my listeners and how supportive you are of me and my show. So thank you for that. Please stick around after the show for the promo trailer for Dead Strange. The show's host, Sophie, has created a weekly show where she dives into some of the strangest true crime cases from around the globe, and I'm so excited to see what cases she's going to tackle for us. She is just beginning her podcast journey, so let's all give her as much support as we can. So make sure to subscribe to Dead Strange wherever you listen and enjoy the ride. Some of her episodes that she has out so far are really interesting. They're all interesting, but some of them are cases that I hadn't heard of. So definitely check it out. Again, thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week when I cover the Moores murders. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Hey everyone, this is Sophie Ray, owner and host of the Dead Strange podcast. Join me every Friday as I talk about the world's most bizarre cases. From maddening unsolved mysteries to murders with an unusual twist. Be sure to subscribe to Dead Strange wherever you get your favourite podcasts and follow Dead Strange Pod across all social media platforms. Bye for now.